Starting Overdrive. Real stories of starting over with Red Seaton.
Hey everyone, welcome to Starting Overdrive, where you'll hear real stories of starting over from real people of all walks of life. I'm your host, Red Seaton. Welcome to part 5 of the Starting Overdrive Turning Point series called Moving into the Unknown. In this new segment of the podcast called Turning Points, I focus on significant life-changing events directly connected to the process of starting over. Events or turning points that alter who we are, force us to change direction in life, and let go of everything we once knew. This segment is an exploration into life-defining, irreversible turning points that rock us to the very core of our being and force us to accept change whether we like it or not. It's through these irreversible turning points that we truly learn who we are on the deepest level, what we can handle in life, the true power of the human spirit, and who we were meant to become. On many levels, who we thought we were before these major life-changing events was only preparing us for who we're supposed to be after the turning point. The following story is an extension of the most important, irreversible turning point that changed my life forever. This episode is a continuation of part 4, in which I told the story of how my life reached a major crossroads in 1991 after being hit by a car in 1985, nearly losing my life, waking up from a week-long coma, and enduring 5 years of recovery, including brain surgery and other life-saving procedures. It was a moment of time in 1991 when my past collided with my present as I stood staring out at the horizon of the Atlantic Ocean, feeling hopeless about my future. My life had reached a dead end after years of having change forced upon me beyond my choice. In part 4, I recalled the many times of my life in which I was forced to deal with change due to circumstances beyond my control or choice. My parents' dysfunctional relationship, moving to a new home, a 10-year period of chaos, instability, and pain, the disintegration of their marriage and eventual divorce, to losing my family, getting hit by a car, spending a week in a coma, 5 years of recovery, and being left behind in life as many peers and friends all move forward. This story, part 5, is about one of the most powerful and profound decisions I've ever made. It's the moment I chose to change my life after years of having no choice but to deal with the ripple effect of change forced upon me. This is the story of taking control of my life in an effort to become the person I always dreamed I could be for the rest of my life. This is the story of leaving everything I knew of my life on the East Coast for a life on the other side of the country on the West Coast where I had never been to before and didn't know anyone. This is my story of starting over when I boarded a train bound for Vancouver, British Columbia with only $300 in my pocket. This is my story of moving into the unknown to change my life by choice. The year was 1993, May 5th. A typical gray day on the east coast of Canada in Halifax, Nova Scotia, as I stood inside the train station, saying goodbye to my family. Goodbyes are never easy. It sounds cliche, but it's true. It's never easy to say goodbye to anyone you love. This day was bittersweet, though, filled with a contrast of emotions that permeated throughout the station. On one level, there was an air of sadness, a strong sense of finality within the stark reality that I was leaving, that my trip wasn't temporary. I would be gone for good. On another level, there was excitement about not only crossing the entire country by train, but also my future and the unknown opportunity that awaited me. I was 23 years old. I had my entire life ahead of me. At the same time, on another deeper level, there was also a sense of acceptance. An acceptance and acknowledgement that there wasn't anything to keep me in my hometown anymore. Everyone knew that I felt hopeless about my future. They knew I wasn't happy, especially after overcoming so much adversity from my accident. They knew my leaving was for the best, despite how painful it was for them to let me go. Several months earlier, at the end of Part 4 in this series, I was standing at the edge of the Shearwater Air Force Base, looking out into the horizon of the Atlantic Ocean, staring into the unknown, contemplating my future as my past and present collided at a crossroads. On that day, I made the most important and profound decision of my life. I had to leave my life as I knew it, and all that was familiar to me. I had to start over. The reality of it was that I had been through too much pain. I had overcome too much adversity in my life. I had already lost myself, my identity, and direction in life as a result of my accident. At the same time, I had already lost my family. I had survived numerous life-saving surgeries and beat the odds in the previous 7 years of my life, only to wind up feeling hopeless about my future. It was time to move into the unknown, rather than continue my life in what I had always known. In 1992, I was lost. Really lost. It's hard for me to put into words just how lost I felt at the time, to be resuming life after 5 years of recovery. During those years, I was in and out of the hospital, recovering from various life-threatening issues and surgeries, all while being in and out of school at the same time, trying to move forward and not fall behind. It was the strangest experience to be knocked out of your life at the age of 16. Have 5 to 6 years pass, and then suddenly you find yourself trying to resume life at 21, as if nothing ever happened. The only way I can describe it today is that it's like experiencing missing time and gaps in your life that you can't quite explain. I wasn't abducted by aliens or anything like that, but I did go missing from my own life, so to speak. I was hit by a car and thrust into a completely different dimension and direction in life. It did feel like I was abducted from my life by forces beyond my control. My moments of missing time were spent in a coma, in the hospital, in surgery, in the intensive care unit, in recovery on the neurological floor. It was very much like being transported to another world. As a result of these experiences in and out of the hospital, it completely changed my association with time and how I perceive time. Looking back now, it does feel like I was hit by a car at the age of 16, was transported back and forth to another planet for 5 years, and then brought back and left to resume life again at 21 as if nothing happened. It was incredibly difficult to reconcile both the past and the present at the time. What did my life mean? Why did it happen to me? Who am I now without all that I've known my entire life? What was my purpose? How can I resume life if I'm not the same person anymore? Who am I now as a result of my accident? Those were very real and heavy questions for me in 1992. The thought of my future only added to the heaviness and weight of hopelessness I felt that year. In 1992, the cost of living was much, much lower than it is today. The average annual household income in the U.S. was $30,000. The average price of a house was $122,000. And the average monthly rent was $519 per month. I can personally confirm the accuracy of monthly rent back then, since only a year earlier, I had moved out for the first time with friends, and the price of our rent per month was $475. I can distinctly remember writing the monthly checks of that amount. 1992 was the same year billionaire businessman Ross Perot ran as an independent in the U.S. election against Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. That year, the space shuttle Endeavour made its maiden voyage into space. Euro Disney opened in France. The North American Free Trade Agreement was signed by the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. The Rodney King riots broke out in Los Angeles. Microsoft released Windows 3.1 in 1992. Prince Charles and Princess Diana separated that year. And the nicotine patch was also released in 1992 to help people quit smoking. In 1992, Basic Instinct, Aladdin, Home Alone 2, and A Few Good Men ruled the movie box office, while Pearl Jam and Nirvana were ushering in a brand new era of music out of Seattle with the grunge movement. As I mentioned at the very end of part 4 in this series, my life had reached a dead end in 1991. After my accident in 1985 at the age of 16, getting hit by a car, waking up from a coma, my 5 years of recovery, enduring many life-saving surgeries, I had resumed my life in 1991 as a young adult. While my life was put on pause, so to speak, that feeling of missing time, my friends and peers had all moved forward in their careers with purpose and direction. I spent 5 years in high school, in and out of the hospital each year, before going on to university to study psychology and sociology. After university, I wound up working for my father in the exact same job I had when I was 16 at the time of my accident. I was pumping gas. I didn't feel good about myself. The economy was depressed in my hometown. There were no better jobs. Not for me. Just as my life was getting started, there were no opportunities on the horizon. I had worked so hard to survive and catch up to life, only to feel worthless and back to square one, with no hope of my future getting any better. At the end of part four, after staring into the crossroads of my life, one path the known of how my life would be, that I could see clearly, the other path the unknown future that I couldn't see at all, the one thing I did know was that I had to take control of my life. After years of having my life dictated by forces beyond my control, it was time to create the life I wanted by choice. I had to leave everything I knew of my life and move forward in the unknown. The decision to leave my hometown was a point of no return for me. It was a decision that I intuitively knew was the right choice for my life. It was the only choice after reaching a major life crossroads. It's interesting to look back on now so many years later, because I can clearly see what was happening internally with me at the time. After my accident, in the later years of my recovery, as I gained strength and a certain sense of normalcy in my life, a new normal, I began to travel. I was restless. After nearly losing my life, confronting death and my own mortality, I had a hard time settling back into the normal routine of life. Normal was the last thing I wanted after everything I had been through. During high school, my recovery, and university, I would periodically take off on weekend road trips with my friends. I just wanted to get away as much as I could. I wanted to live. It was a simmering, percolating feeling of life I had never felt before. I wanted to feel alive and experience life, even if I wasn't 100% better or recovered. It started with road trips around my home province of Nova Scotia. I had to get away. We'd travel to small towns and explore different places for the weekend. We'd see local bands, experience the nightlife, and have fun. Between 1987 and 1992, we scoured the province, visiting places we hadn't been to before, and lived life to the fullest. Nova Scotia isn't that big of a province. All told, the entire population of the province is about 1 million people, with half of that living in the capital city of Halifax, where I grew up. Nova Scotia is a peninsula on the east coast of Canada that's roughly 580 kilometers long, no more than 130 kilometers wide, 55,000 square kilometers, including Cape Breton Island, and 3,800 other coastal islands. It's a beautiful province, and was an amazing place to grow up. The people of Nova Scotia are proud, friendly, with strong cultural values, morals, principles, and an incredible work ethic. I'm incredibly proud to say that I'm originally from Nova Scotia. It wasn't too long before my friends and I had explored most of the province in the span of my 5-year recovery. To this day, I'm not quite sure if my friends actually knew or recognized what was happening with me at the time. After nearly losing my life, having my life put on pause for so many years, I was living my own lust for life by traveling and exploring. The reality was, after all the surgeries over the years, after all the time spent in and out of the hospital, I couldn't resume my life in the same way I was living it prior to getting hit by a car. What many people didn't understand at the time, and perhaps still don't to this day, was that I had already been to the edge of life and death before my adult life had even begun. Not once, not twice, several times. I had seen and experienced a side of life, also a state in between life, that was drastically different than the life my friends and family were leading. I didn't choose to see or experience these sides of life either. As a result of getting hit by a car, waking up from a coma, my recovery, all the life-saving surgeries, it left me with a deep simmering yearning, a longing, an overflowing passion to make the most out of life, to live life to the fullest, to experience the essence of life in every waking moment, and to not take life for granted, especially knowing how precious life really is, since we only have one life to live. After exploring the entire province of Nova Scotia in the years following my accident, fueled by that very passion to live life, I began to explore even further beyond the provincial boundaries. During my last year of high school and into my years of university, I started to make regular trips to Montreal, Quebec. A couple of years earlier, my friends and I had made a road trip to Montreal, and we all had a memorable, amazing time. If you've never been to Montreal, it's an amazing, eclectic, and cosmopolitan city, rich in French culture, history, and modern urban progression. Unlike most cities in Canada, it has much more of a European flair, with a palpable cultural pride and independence. There was an electricity within the vibe of Montreal that I loved, that made me feel alive. It was different. The people were different. The food was different. The language was different. And as a result of my accident, I was different. Each time I returned home from Montreal, I couldn't wait to go back. It got to a point where I was heading to Montreal on a semi-regular basis every few weeks. Some weekends, even back-to-back trips. There'd be many times I'd be out with friends, downtown at the local pubs, or at the end of the night we'd all decide to go to Montreal and head directly to the airport. Once at the airport, we'd buy student standby tickets to catch the first flight out in the morning. Once in Montreal, we'd find a room at a downtown hotel and stay for the weekend. There were many times I'd land in Montreal and have to buy a change of clothes for the weekend. It didn't cost that much, but it was just all spontaneous, spur of the moment, living life to the fullest. Out-of-the-box things that no one, certainly none of my friends or family, would ever dream of doing. Going to Montreal on a whim? Are you crazy? To stray that far out of the box would be reckless and irresponsible. To me, however, it was living and being alive. The seed to leave was already planted years earlier. That yearning for something different, that passion to explore, was like a plant growing roots inside of me for years. The plant of life. My life. That's why I felt so hopeless about my future in 1992. I couldn't settle for a life of unhappiness. I couldn't settle for a life without opportunity. After all that I had endured, after all that I had been through, I had to live life to the fullest, even if that meant leaving everything I knew behind. There was so much of life to explore that I hadn't seen or experienced. It was time to take control of life, to live my life. There I stood in 1993, at the train station, within the most important decision of my life, staring at my family, smiling in excitement and sadness. My mother, my father, my sister, my niece, my everything. I was leaving for good. They knew it. I knew it. There was no going back. I felt bad for them, especially my niece. She was too young to understand the complexities and dynamics of why I was leaving. I also felt bad for my mother, who I knew would be more alone than ever before. Looking back now, she had just turned 60 years old that same year and was on the back end of her life. Like I mentioned before, my father had remarried, but my mother had remained single, by choice. It wasn't that she never had opportunities to find someone to share her life with. She had many over the years. I often talked with her about the reasons why and how she felt about being alone. Over time, I really grew to understand and respect her choices. Being alone was a form of empowerment for her, a way for her to maintain control over her life without being vulnerable to someone else's weaknesses, which in turn can activate and enable your own weaknesses. Being alone after two marriages was a way for her to retain her strength. She could maintain her individual power while also managing her life without the drama and bullshit of a relationship. It was just easier to be by herself than to deal with the complexities of a relationship. My mother really knew herself deep down. She was incredibly self-aware. At the same time, my mother had a difficult time admitting that she also needed people in her life. She longed for close relationships, but had a difficult time being vulnerable and letting people in. She was afraid of getting hurt. At the end of the day, I was her only son, and it hurt me to know that I was leaving her alone. But I also knew she was incredibly strong and self-reliant. She wanted that for me as well. She wanted me to be happy, even if it meant that she'd be alone. The last thing my mother would ever want is for me to be unhappy so she could be happy. Both of my parents were great that way. They never wanted to hold me back from the life I wanted for myself. I talk to them often about this very subject, open and honestly. I believe everyone has a right to lead the life they want, without feeling guilty, even if that life is different than what their parents did or wanted. I could never understand my friends who said in their late teens or early 20s that they could never leave their parents. And there were a lot of them back then who I remember saying that. To each his own, sure, everyone's different, but I couldn't comprehend how people at such a young age would choose to live their lives for their parents. I mean, their parents made their own choices to lead the lives they wanted. Why wouldn't their kids be afforded that same right? Would their parents really want them to give up their hopes and dreams? Don't get me wrong. I understand the many dynamics associated with life-changing decisions of that magnitude. But my lens and perspective on this is much different. It was drastically different at the time. My family was fractured, split, with many divided loyalties on both sides, and I had already lost my family unit when my parents divorced. So I just couldn't understand how someone would give up their own life at 20 to make their parents happy, even if it meant the next 50 years would be filled with unhappiness and unrealized dreams. I just couldn't do it. And to this day, I'm eternally grateful to my parents for allowing me to find my life. On that day in May 1993, at the train station on the East Coast, my life was waiting for me in the unknown on the West Coast. As I stood inside the train station, I could see out the door, across the huge spacious lobby, to the awaiting passenger train outside on the tracks, the train that was bound for Vancouver, British Columbia, and would take me across the entire country from one coast to the other, where I was about to start over. When I think about that day now, the goodbye was just like you'd see in the movies. The misty steam rising out from underneath the train as it prepared to leave, while the conductor walked the track, making his final checks, as you said a final teary-eyed goodbye to your loved ones. Reflecting on that moment so many years later, I wondered just how many people experienced the same life-changing moment as they were boarding a train into their own unknown future. Constructed in Halifax's South End, on the waterfront of Halifax Harbor, the train station opened in 1928 and was built out of white limestone with a high-arched ceiling and a massive 1,500-foot covered train shed for passengers boarding and disembarking. The train station played a pivotal role in World War II, moving military personnel to East Coast bases and overseas. Needless to say, the station played host to many similar teary-eyed goodbyes during wartime. With $300 in my pocket, all the money to my name, I boarded the train, found a seat, and waved goodbye to my family as the locomotive pulled away. For the next 30 minutes, I sat in silence, watching my hometown pass before my eyes for the final time. It was happening. I was committed. There was no turning back. I was really leaving to create a new life for myself. If you've never taken a trip across the entire country, it's an amazing experience. The sights, the stops, the places, and the people you meet, it was unforgettable. I'd recommend it to anyone. At the time, I was still young enough to qualify for a student discount on a one-way ticket across the country. All told, the one-way ticket cost $299 for general coach seating. All days combined, the trip was scheduled to take 5 full days to cross Canada, coast to coast. The first leg was an overnight stop in Montreal. The second, another overnight stop in Toronto. The remaining 3 days and nights would be spent on board the train with minimal stops along the way, leaving Ontario and passing through Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and then finally, British Columbia. To this day, people still ask me why I chose to move so far away, from one coast to another, to settle in British Columbia, a place I'd never been to before. People often ask me how I knew that it was right for me at the time, given that it was in the unknown. There are two main reasons why I chose to move so far away. The first, living on the east coast of Canada, the typical and easiest move to make to a bigger city is Toronto. It's only a 2-hour plane ride back to Nova Scotia to visit family, or for family to visit you. Toronto, it's really not that far away, but still far enough to make your own life in a bigger city. A lot of East Coasters also move out to Alberta for work in the oil industry. When the oil industry is booming, East Coasters can find work in Alberta and make more money in 1 year than they'd make in 5 or 10 on the East Coast. In 1 or 2 years working in Alberta, people can move back east, buy a home, and have a nice nest egg in the bank for the future. It's been that way for a long, long time, and part of the cultural fabric and identity of the Atlantic provinces. It's incredibly hard work, tough on families, but the trades pay incredibly well when the oil industry's booming. I wasn't a trades guy, so Alberta was out of the question for me. Back in 1992 and 1993, when I had made the decision to leave, a lot of people I knew who'd gone to Toronto to live would come back complaining. Not everyone, but there were quite a few people I knew who'd returned to the East Coast after experiencing some type of negativity. Don't get me wrong, Toronto's a great city. I've been there many times. I don't know if it was too big of a culture clash or culture shock for some to handle, but back then, I saw those negative experiences as red flags, since so many people were returning unhappy after trying to make it in Toronto. At the same time, I also knew a lot of people who made the trip out to British Columbia for visits or to live temporarily. Growing up as a kid, The iconic long-running Canadian television series, The Beachcombers, was filmed in British Columbia. That was my only real reference of what the province looked like. It was a show about the adventures of a log salvager and his friends in Gibson's, BC, a tiny harbor town along the Strait of Georgia, adjacent to a stunning Pacific Northwestern mountain backdrop. The setting on the Sunshine Coast of BC was, and still is, beautiful, stunningly beautiful. As compared to those I knew returning to Nova Scotia from Toronto, not one person ever had a bad thing to say about British Columbia after visiting or living there. In that final year, I even searched people out who I knew had lived in BC at one point, and the response was always overwhelmingly positive. No one was returning from British Columbia or Vancouver with anything bad to say. In fact, it was the opposite. Most said they couldn't wait to go back. That's really how I chose BC and Vancouver. I thought to myself, well, something good must be going on out there if people are having such positive experiences. That's exactly what I want for my future. I wanted to be happy. The second reason for moving so far away was born out of the fact that I wasn't happy about who I was on the East Coast at the time. My life was put on pause for 5 to 6 years because of my accident, my coma, my recovery, and there were things about myself that I wanted to change. Like I mentioned before, once I was past my recovery at the age of 21 and 22, it was like I was resuming my life again from who I was at the age of 16 when I was hit by a car. Just when I was beginning my life as a young adult, it felt like I was missing years, important years between 16 and 22 when you become more focused, disciplined, responsible, independent, self-reliant, career-oriented with direction. As a result of my accident, the fact was, I was left behind in many of those important personal development aspects of life. With little opportunity in my hometown, also feeling hopeless about my future, the type of personal change I wanted to make for myself seemed impossible. Maybe not impossible, but the type of changes I needed to make as a person for my future were years away on the path I was heading in my hometown. In order for me to be the person I wanted to be, and knew that I could be, I needed to leave. I needed a fresh start. I made the conscious decision to leave and move so far away that I'd be forced to change without any temptation or easy accessibility to return home with my tail between my legs when times get tough. Montreal was too close. Toronto was still too close. Vancouver, British Columbia, though, was far enough away on the other side of the country that I couldn't easily run away when times get hard. I chose to put myself in a place where I'd be forced to change for the better. After all, I had already lived what seemed like an entire lifetime of having change forced upon me. This time, I was determined to leverage that forced change to become the person I knew I could be and envisioned in the future. There are times in life when being uncomfortable and forced to change is the most powerful thing you can do for yourself, especially when you're finally ready to commit to doing everything it takes to change your life for the better. The only way change comes easy is when you're truly ready to embrace the process and all that comes with transforming yourself. When you're ready to change, I mean truly ready from the core of your being, you can then enjoy the process. And really, when you think about it, why wouldn't you want to enjoy your own self-growth and transformation? When the train arrived in Montreal the first night, the trip didn't really feel like a permanent journey. Since I had already been there many times before on spontaneous road trips to explore and feel alive, the first leg of my trip was still more known than unknown. I remember heading to the famous Peel Pub for drinks and to watch the playoff game between the Montreal Canadiens and the Buffalo Sabres. The next day in Toronto, the trip still felt more known than unknown. The highlight of that evening was seeing the Toronto Blue Jays take on the Baltimore Orioles at the Sky Dome. There were two things that made that game so special. The starting pitcher for the Orioles was the legendary Hall of Famer, Fernando Valenzuela, who returned to Major League Baseball after leaving the league the year before to play in Mexico. I was truly excited to see Valenzuela, even though he was on the back end of his career. The second special moment came late in the game, when Blue Jays slugger Joe Carter hit a home run to win the game. That memory became all the more special when that same year in 1993, Joe Carter hit a home run in the bottom of the ninth inning in Game 6 of the World Series to give the Toronto Blue Jays their second consecutive World Series title. The third day of the trip on the train is when I truly felt like I was moving into the unknown. Heading west through Ontario during the third day, the train made its way toward the Manitoba border. In 1993, there were no cell phones, laptops, tablets, or portable entertainment devices. Not like there are today. When I wasn't staring out the window, watching the scenery, dreaming of what life would be like in Vancouver, I was either reading in my seat, lounging in the observation deck, where you had a panoramic glass view of scenery outside, which you can see photos of on the Starting Over Drive Instagram page, or I was sitting in the bar car at the end of the train. I do have to say, the greatest thing about traveling by train across Canada, which is a huge country, the second largest in the world, is the amount of different people you meet along the way. I was one of the few passengers on that trip who would be making a coast-to-coast journey. Each day I'd head to the bar car, grab a coffee or beer, and talk with whoever was on board. Each stop, different people came and went. I met so many people during that five-day period that I still have fond memories of various conversations to this day. I had so many questions for people. I was curious about their lives and what led them to this moment on the train. Looking back now, in many ways, the transient nature of relationships on the train during that trip prepared me for the changing nature of relationships of life in the big city, especially life downtown in a city like Vancouver, where people come and go every few years. The train arrived in Winnipeg, Manitoba, late on the third night. It was around 11:30 p.m. Most everything was closed, and I had to physically look at a map to see where the train station was in the city. Passengers had a 30-minute stop to get out, walk around, and stretch the legs. I got off the train with map in hand and stood underneath a streetlight to see exactly where I was. I quickly noticed the train wasn't far from the famous intersection in Winnipeg known as Portage and Main, where Route 85, Portage Avenue, intersects with Route 52, Main Street. It's a famous Canadian intersection known as the Crossroads of Canada because its relative proximity to the actual longitudinal center of Canada. It was a few blocks away, but I thought to myself, who knows when I'll get to Winnipeg again? So I ran as fast as I could to the intersection through the dark and empty streets to actually say I stood at the corner of Portage and Main, the center of Canada. It was a truly liberating experience to be standing at the crossroads of Canada, knowing only a few months earlier in 1992, I was standing within my own crossroads, making the decision to leave my life on the East Coast. In many ways, the journey across Canada into the unknown actually began that night on the corner of Portage and Main, when my own crossroads in the past came full circle to intersect with my present and the future that was awaiting for me on the West Coast. I was standing at the center of my own personal journey, a crossroads that was evidence of how far I'd come from feeling hopeless about my future. The journey through Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, the prairie provinces, was a time of deep reflection and letting go on a scale I'd never experienced before. There's something so soothing and therapeutic about traveling across the prairies that's difficult to articulate. It's a unique experience in which you can feel any and all stress actually leave your body as you travel across miles and miles of nothing. There's nothing to see except big sky and flat fields of wheat, crops, and grasslands for hundreds of miles. It's just endless miles of flat nothing. It's beautiful. Since there's nothing externally to see outward where the horizon meets the sky for miles, the prairies force you to go organically inward into yourself. Think about it. Most cities and towns keep you busy and distracted on a daily basis. There's very little time in our busy daily lives to go inward into ourselves on deeper levels to resolve internal conflict. The prairies not only force you to confront the conflicts within yourself, but the region also gives you the opportunity to breathe out those conflicts, make sense of them, and let go of the turmoil, so you're not carrying conflict into the future. As I stared out into the endless fields of wheat for hours on end, reflecting on my past, present, and future, I reconnected with the vast expanse of nothing within myself. That state of deep reflection while traveling across the prairies was very much like connecting to the vast expanse of nothing within myself when I was in a coma. In resolving and letting go of some of my own inner conflict from the past, and my accident, while traveling toward my own unknown future, the only thing that mattered was the now, the moment, the nothing of the now within me as I traveled across the external nothing outside the window of the train. One of the most memorable and profound experiences of the trip came in Saskatchewan during the middle of the night. I was sitting in the observation car, which gave you a panoramic view of the landscape outside, when the elusive northern lights appeared, dancing in the sky above in the distance. Known as the aurora, polar lights, The northern lights are a natural light display mostly seen in high-latitude regions and are the result of disturbances in the magnetosphere caused by solar wind. I was mesmerized, transfixed, by the green-blue hue of lights dancing in the sky above me as I crossed the prairies in a tiny boxcar of a train. It was one of the most beautiful and natural moments of my life. I was one with the earth, the sky, the lights, the wind, and myself, all at the same moment in time. That night I fell asleep to the northern lights in a calm connection to everything around me. At 6 a.m. in the morning, with the train coming to a stop, I remember waking up to the bright light of morning sunshine, long enough to read the sign out the window that read, Saskatoon. I was too tired to stay awake, but I knew Edmonton, Alberta, would be the next major stop about 7 hours away later that day. Sure enough, in the early afternoon, the city of Edmonton came into view in the distance from the observation car. I was familiar with Edmonton since my sister moved there when I was 11 years old, and I had visited the city a few times with my mother. Back then, it was an exciting time to visit the city of Edmonton, since it was during the era when Wayne Gretzky played for the Edmonton Oilers of the NHL. I was fortunate to have seen a couple games at the Northlands Coliseum during that Gretzky era. It was an electric, exciting time for the city back then. I still have a business card from Wayne Gretzky's first clothing business in Edmonton called Wayne Gretzky's Western Wear. Pulling into Edmonton, I remember some of the cross streets as we passed the suburbs of where my sister used to live. Also the mall and movie theater, where I saw the sci-fi film Tron for the first time when I was 13. The stop in Edmonton was long enough to pick up and drop off passengers before heading toward and into the Rocky Mountains en route to British Columbia. I remember pulling away from Edmonton with a sense of excitement, but also an awkward nervousness. I was getting closer to my final destination. Vancouver was only one more full day away. This was the final leg of my journey. Was I ready? What would it be like? What if I didn't have enough money? Could I really find work? What type of work would I find? Where would I live? Could I really make it on my own? Would I really make it on my own? I had so many questions with unknown answers. The only thing I was certain of at that point in my journey, I was determined to find the right answers to my questions. Traveling by train through the Rocky Mountains was another memorable, profound experience. The many bridges you cross, the many tunnels you go through, the many snow-capped mountains you meander through, the rivers, the wilderness, the wild animals, the lakes, the ice fields, the natural mineral mines. Each one reinforced just how stunningly beautiful Canada really is as a country. I remember crossing more than a few 20 to 30 story high old bridges like you see in the movies, old tracks that run along the edge of a mountain where you can barely see the bottom far below. Some parts of the trip through the Rockies and into BC are not for the faint of heart. There's something about the Rockies that aligns with my soul. It's hard to explain. It's a feeling of deep knowing, a good feeling of connection with the environment. Traveling through the mountains, I felt a sense of freedom, of hope, of rebellion, of independence, a sense of possibility, and perhaps more importantly, a sense of spiritual stillness. As the train snaked its way through the mountains, it was as if the land outside was saying to me, "You're on the right track." The final few hours on the train were more anxious than any other on the trip. I felt a nervous excitement. After 5 semi-sleepless nights, traveling from the known into the unknown, the train trip was coming to an end. My entire life was waiting for me beyond the train station in Vancouver. Although I had so many questions about the uncertainty of my future, the one thing I was certain about was my mission to find work right away. That was the key to getting set up quickly and up and running in a new city. To be perfectly candid here, and I've never talked about this until now with you, growing up in a region where there wasn't much work, where employment was hard to come by, left me with a lot of negative feelings of impossibility, that no matter how hard I tried, I'd never be able to find work. No matter how much talent, ambition, or potential that I had, I wouldn't be able to put any of it to use for my future simply because of the circumstances within my environment. As I neared my final destination of Vancouver, British Columbia, I thought to myself, if all of the people in that city can find work and create a future for themselves, so can I. If other people are living happily in Vancouver with decent jobs, so can I. It's absolutely possible. It's not a matter of if I'll find work. It's a matter of when. I'm not going to stop searching for work, even if it takes me weeks, months, or years. There's no turning back. There's no going home a failure. On that day, as the train made its way toward Vancouver, I made a deep commitment to myself to do whatever it took to succeed. The day was May 11th, 1993, a Tuesday, when the train pulled into the Pacific Central Station in downtown Vancouver. It was a beautiful sunny day and warm at 20 degrees Celsius. It was like a summer day. I couldn't believe the weather. I remember that day like it was yesterday. I stepped off the train, grabbed my bags, made my way through the station, and out to the front of the building, where my breath was taken away by the picturesque snow-capped mountains in the distance and the beautiful flowers in full bloom at the park in front of me. I stood and smiled, breathing in the moment from my soul. Everything about that day felt right. I was finally on the West Coast for the first time. I had finally arrived. I was standing in the unknown. I was home. Stay tuned for the next episode of Starting Over Drive Turning Points called Lost in a New Home, in which I tell the story of settling into life in a new city where I began to feel lost all over again as I embraced the process of finding a new identity, who I really was on the West Coast. Thanks for listening to the Starting Over Drive podcast. Join us next time for another real story of starting over. In the meantime, make sure to follow us on Spotify, YouTube, Amazon, Stitcher, and all major podcasting platforms. Head to the Starting Over Drive Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our channels, help us grow, and feel free to share your story of starting over, or even let us know if you relate to any of the issues touched upon in our interviews. You can also find us at the Starting Over Drive podcast at the official site, www.startingoverdrive.com.